Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
All right, guys, we are here today for a special episode with Beth Braden, who is a journalist with Luna Shark. Beth has been on the show before, and we're very excited to have you back, Beth. We have continued the conversation off the air. We've been, tweeting. What do you call X? Like Xing? We've been Xing now? I don't know.
I think so. I don't know. I don't think you can say DMs because that sounds inappropriate.
We've been communicating on X would be the right way to say it. But we have found out that we are aware of some serial killer activity in Campbell County, which is my hometown. So Beth has researched this, and we would just kind of want to talk about it. So welcome, Beth.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me back. This I'm really excited to talk about this. It comes from actually an article that I did when I worked at the La Follette Press in 2013. So it's crazy to me that I've been doing this long enough that my original article is more than a decade old, but it was still one of my favorite ones to write.
Time flies when you're having fun. The Follett Press is like the newspaper of Campbell County. There might be some smaller ones in Jellicoe. I think they kind of go in and out of style, but the La Follette Press has been there forever. I mean, my whole life for sure. And way before that, catch us up on what you've been doing over at Luna Shark, though. I know Alex Murdaugh's keeping you busy. Anything else going on? Or tell us about that a little bit.
You know, Alex Murdaugh keeps Alex Murdaughing is really that's really the best way to put it. He is attempting to get a new trial, and I don't see that happening whatsoever.
For the murder conviction.
Yes, he's trying to get a new trial for the murder conviction on the basis that the Colleton County clerk of court tampered with the jury is his allegation. And I will spare you the legal nitty gritty nuts and bolts. It's a fascinating thing to dive into. But basically, the judge that is overseeing this motion is not tolerating any of his attorney's shenanigans, I guess is a good way to put it. So she is limiting their inquiry into the jury to very specifics of what did you hear Becky Hill say? When did you hear? And Becky Hill's the clerk of court. What did you hear Becky say? When did you hear her say it? And did it affect your verdict? Are basically the only questions that his defense attorneys are going to be allowed to ask the jurors. So I think that that's really going to cut down on some of the, allegations back and forth that you've heard, bandied about in the media. There's more to it. And we're really looking forward to that evidentiary hearing being done on January, hearing set for January 29th through the 31st, I believe. And then we're looking forward to being able to go on to some other cases because, there's still the death of Stephen Smith that hasn't been solved. There's still, the Grant Solomon case from here in Tennessee that we would like to, shed some more sunlight on and see if we can find some answers. And, we get tips and people asking for helps so much. And there's so much more that we want to be able to do, but it's also very important especially for Mandy and Liz to see this Alex Murdaugh thing through to the end.
Where is he at with all of his litigation for the financial misdeeds? Is that over, still in the middle of that? I can't remember.
He pleaded guilty in November and then was sentenced right after Thanksgiving. The number escapes me right now, but he took a plea on the financial crimes. And that'll land him in state prison. You'll fix me stumbling over that. But yeah, I don't I don't remember right off the number of years. I want to say it was 27 years he got for the financial crimes, but he's already serving two life sentences for the murder of Maggie Murdaugh and Paul Murdaugh. So it's not like he's getting out of prison. And even in a bizarro world where he gets out of the murder charge, which isn't going to happen. Like, he's in his 50s, 27 years in prison is the end of Alex Murdoch's.
Right. Yeah.
I feel like that would be one for me too, and I'm not even that old. But I mean, yeah, you mentioned the Stephen Smith, the Grant Solomon case is one that's near and dear to Jamie and I. We were able to have Lauren.
Yeah, Lauren Carlin. That's Carlin. How we originally connected with Beth too.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that I follow that case. Well, I keep saying I correct myself every time because it's not a case. It just it needs to be a case.
Currently,
so
a story should be a case.
It's a situation. Yeah.
And a horrible situation.
It's one that I hope, you know, will come to light. So that's one I'm really excited for Luna Shark to be able to join Lauren and everything she's doing. And I think you all getting your hands on it, just I think it's going to make it so big of a story and so out there that people have to look at it. So I'm really excited to get you all in on that one. I know his family deserves justice for sure. And you know, at the end of the day, maybe an investigation says it was a crazy accident. But at least it will be investigated is my hopes.
Right. Like, my thing is, Angie and Gracie both deserve the peace of knowing that what happened to Grant got the attention that it needed and that it deserved.
Yep.
And even as we've worked on Murdoch, like, I didn't quit researching the Grant Solomon thing. Like, it takes a while to, you know, do good research on something that complicated. So, yeah, the research has continued. It's there. And we're just waiting on some Murdoch stuff to get out of the way so we can go back to devoting good time to Grant and to Stephen.
Awesome. Well, we're really excited about that. And we'll keep all of you all posted on what's going on there and if Luna Shark's doing anything else. Let's talk about some Campbell County, Tennessee murders. Campbell County has two cities that are noteworthy, Jellicoe, the smaller, and La Follette. La Follette also has like Jacksboro and Carrollville that are like right there together. But really, we're talking about something that happened along I-75. And if you've ever traveled on I-75, going south from Tennessee, going down towards Knoxville, you'll see an exit called Stinking Creek. And I'm sure if you've ever seen it, you remember it because that's a funny name.
It's a funny name, and that it's better now. But going across that mountain on the interstate used to be the worst section of interstate in the history of everything, especially when the weather was bad.
I feel like my adult life, America's been in the war, and 75 has construction in that stretch of road. Like, it's
bad. That is the truth. Well, my high school played Jellicoe for football and basketball, and I was in band, so you'd have to ride the bus to Jellicoe from Oneida. And going up and over the mountain, that was an experience.
No.
Yeah, we're not allowed to talk about Oneida and Jellicoe football on here, Beth, so we're just going to keep moving.
It's too much of a crime. So
they beat us in the playoffs one year, my senior year, and I'm still very salty about that.
Year one and into year two of True Crime Cast, I bet we covered 5 to 6 Campbell County cases.
Yeah.
And none of those are what's coming up today, right?
Yeah, these are
different.
I feel like one of the murders we talked about could have been the serial killer we're going to talk about, but we don't know for sure.
Right. It's just fascinating to me. You use the word cities. I feel like that's a little liberal. Beth may disagree with me there. They're towns, maybe. Boroughs.
Municipalities.
Very small. So for there to be that level of crime, and everywhere has crime, of course. It's just interesting that we end up talking about it so much.
Yeah. Golly. I know we talked about Kenny Bartley, who was a school shooter at Campbell County. My mm-hmm. mother-in-law was in the building at the time. There was a teacher that was arrested for and convicted of murder. I can't remember mm-hmm. his last name right now. It's escaping me. He was
Van? Was it
Lonnie Van? He was actually Van. My mm-hmm. teacher in middle school for a hot minute.
Really? Yep. That happened. I was already away from the press when that happened. Yep. But I was
that was
glued.
A huge story.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of crime. I mean, we could just do a Campbell County true crime podcast. But tell us, Beth, you've been researching this. Tell us a little bit about it. What's going on here?
Yeah. So I went back to my buddy who still works at the press. And I was like, you know, send me that article I wrote from 2013. No, I don't know when I did it. There were leaves on the trees, but send me the article. So he dug through the archives for me. And my plan in 2013 had been to go over Campbell County's cold cases. And there were actually four different cold cases at the time that I talked about. Two of them have actually been identified, like, since I wrote the article in 2013, which is really cool. The serial killer tie-in was confirmed, and it goes back to the redhead murders that were happening in the 1980s. So redheaded women kept turning up, I think, along interstates for the most part, like in seven or eight different states. And at the time, they were considering, so this would have been 1985. Picture it, 1985.
I was alive.
January 1st, yeah. January 1st of 1985, a woman is found near the Stinking Creek exit in Campbell County. And I think, like, we can talk about the Stinking Creek exit. Like, it gets its name from, like, that Sulphur Creek that's there. It literally is a Stinking Creek. And the southbound Stinking Creek exit practically exits to a gravel road, to be quite honest. So it is remote. And I know how dark it is up there at night now. I can't imagine how much darker and desolate it would have felt in the mid-80s.
Right.
There is literally nothing there. It's an exit, but, I mean, picture an exit that literally just goes off, like Beth said, into a dirt road. There's not a gas station on this exit. There's not a restaurant. There is nothing. This is basically an access part or an access road to get to, like, to help people on the mountain get to the interstate. Otherwise, it would take them an hour and a half to get from their homes to the interstate. This cuts out a little bit of that, but there is nothing off this exit except for mountains and dark.
Yeah, it is. And there's very little, like, the cell signal up there now still isn't great. I mean, in 1985, there weren't cell phones. But
right.
Anyway, this woman, she was found January 1st, 1985. And at the time, she was estimated to be in her late teens or early 20s. Later, during the autopsy, they actually learned she was pregnant at the time of her death. She was found wearing a velour shirt from JCPenney, which is, I guess, like poor man's velvet.
I was going to say, can you talk to me like I'm five and explain that?
Yeah. And she had on newer looking Levi blue jeans, peach colored underwear, but no bra and no shoes. She did have pierced ears, but no earrings. And her hands and feet had been tied with cloth. Like the same kind of material as like a sheet or a pillowcase. So kind of like linen. She had a pillowcase over her head and her mouth was gagged.
And cause of death.
So I was looking through that and I assume strangulation. Just because she did have linen tied around her neck. Like, it was tied really tight. And I want to say strangulation was ultimately what they decided because she didn't have any stab wounds.
See, I was thinking but there are some victims that do have stab wounds.
Yep. There are two other victims that we will get to that I think are probably unrelated to this, but that were stabbed. This woman from 1985 does not have any stab wounds. And then also at the scene, they found two condom wrappers near the body. One was empty. One was unopened. There were also a couple cigarette butts, which reminds me of our intern at the La Follette Press referred to those L&M cigarettes as La Follette Marlboros.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I love that.
So I don't know if it was a La Follette Marlboro up there with her. The report was just cigarette butts. Let's see. She had some dental work done at some point, on her front teeth. Like they were like one of those like plate bridge things. I don't know what you call them. But her other teeth were in good shape. So like she basically, it looked like she had lived somewhere, you know, like she was missing from somewhere. I get the feeling that it's not like they thought she was a sex worker or anything like that. She appeared to be, you know, by all intents and purposes, a pretty normal person.
It doesn't seem like usually when we talk about victims of serial killers, we see sex workers, we see like homeless transient people who no one is going to report missing, unfortunately. But just based on what we see of her, she sounds like, you know, somebody that could be in my family or somebody who I could work with. Like, Levi jeans are not cheap. And, you know, she had on decent clothes. They were newer clothes. She had dental work. So it's, I mean, no less sad or tragic, but it seems like someone who was not a sex worker or a homeless person.
Mm-hmm. So, and in 1985, I wrote this in my original article, the Knoxville Journal had explored the possibility that this woman was the victim of the serial killer trucker, Jerry Johns. Right after, probably within 2 months of this woman being found, Jerry Johns had assaulted a woman in West Knoxville. And he had strangled her and left her for dead, but she survived, which is crazy to me. That woman was a sex worker, apparently. I was digging through like the newspaper.com archives, and that woman was a dancer of some sort. And the Knoxville Journal at the time had reported that Johns had an alibi for January 1st. Which was interesting. I found out today, because I do have a newspapers.com subscription, that the New Sentinel, so the other paper in Knoxville, had found the link to Johns, you know, by March. They knew it, and it was being reported. It's just not something that I knew in 2013.
I feel like Jamie and I covered a case where a body was found, like, it wasn't close to the interstate. It was, like, on a logging road between Stinking Creek and a community called Elk Valley. And a woman was found in the middle of the woods there. And some people think that that woman may be tied back to Johns as well. I'll have to research that case a little bit more, and we can talk about it later and maybe tie it into this too, if it potentially is.
Yeah, I feel like Jerry Johns could be his own podcast. Because the more that I was reading about that, like, there's cases of his all over the place. As for his, you know, East Tennessee connection, the New Sentinel had saw the Johns link by March of 1985. The woman that he reportedly assaulted and kidnapped in Knoxville had a knot tied around her neck, tied very similarly to the Campbell County Jane Doe knot, which is what kind of, put them on to that.
Was anything notable about the knot? Was it like, I don't know, I know Boy Scouts and military folks can tie some knots that are very unique and identifiable, but that wasn't part of the report?
Yeah, no, the New Sentinel article that I found in the archives earlier when I was flipping through, it didn't, all it said was that the knot was similar, so I have no idea. It's, you know, they couldn't say, they didn't name the knot.
Right, right.
Also, sorry, I'm just thinking of questions like, how in 1985, how precise could they have been on day of death? So he may have an alibi for January 1st, but was this woman found immediately after she was murdered? Or could there have been other possible dates that she was murdered and left?
Exactly. That's not super clear. I want to say I saw something that estimated she'd been dead for a few days before she was found.
Yeah.
So I would love to, like, pick the brain of the Knoxville Journal reporter who initially was like, oh, no, he's got an alibi. Like,
yeah. Well, let's look at the 29th.
Yeah, that's a pretty big statement to make.
Yeah, what were you doing? Yeah, what were you doing on Christmas Day? Yeah. So
I just think that, you know, science is, I mean, it can only get you so far. And in 1985, I think, you know, 12 hours could make a huge difference. Or God forbid, 24 hours. So I don't know. I don't necessarily think that his alibi for that particular day on January 1st really amounts to that much.
Right. I agree. I would love to see how this compares, like how this time frame compares to the work that Dr. Bill Bass was doing at UT at the time, because, you know, Dr. Bass, do you guys know about Dr. Bass?
I'm assuming he's connected to the body farm.
Yes.
Okay. So yeah, tell us more about the body farm.
Oh, man. I'm going off the cuff here a little bit on my body farm knowledge because I am fascinated by the entire place. But Dr. Bass is the father of forensic science, especially like when it's used in a crime fighting, like crime solving kind of scenario. So one of the things that we have at UT here in Knoxville is the body farm. I don't remember what date it was established, but the idea is that people will donate their bodies to science, and that has allowed forensic anthropologists to put the bodies outside in different conditions, in different temperatures, covered, not covered, partially buried, different times a year, that kind of thing. And being able to do those experiments has allowed them to lay the forensic groundwork to say, like, oh, if there's this certain kind of insect on the body, then it's a good bet that the body's been here X amount of days. Or, you know, if there's maggots, then we know that death happened within this. Yep. Here's how a body changes if it's outdoors in the summer versus in the winter. So that's the kind of thing that, like, Dr. Bass helped pioneer among a bunch of other stuff. But he basically created forensic science in this matter. So it would just be interesting to see, like, where was he at in his work during the time that, you know, this woman's body was found?
I hope I'm not getting her mixed up with one of your other victims that we'll talk about. But I know one of the victims, and I think it was her, was actually sent to Texas, where her remains remain to this mm-hmm. day. And I thought, man, that's so weird, because just 30 miles down the road is UT, who is like the front runner in research in death and decomposition. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting that it didn't go there. It's in Texas.
I know. Yeah, I thought that struck me weird too. Yeah, in 2013, I reported that her remains became part of the University of North Texas's Project Eden. So, and that stands for Everyone Deserves a Name. And ultimately, like, they did a facial reconstruction with her skull to, you know, try to see what she would have looked like and really clear that up. UNT still had her remains in 2013 when I wrote the article, and Jerry Johns was in a Tennessee prison. So he had gotten 73 years for assaulting the West Knoxville woman. And when I wrote this story, the case file in Campbell County had a letter from 1994 that Jerry Johns wrote to the sheriff in Campbell County. I wrote in my article then that, like, it was unclear if anybody ever actually, like, reached back out to Jerry Johns to find out what he had to say.
In his letter, it basically said, I didn't do it, but I have information that would be helpful to you. And
nobody what responds. Happened? Yeah.
That sheriff, if I'm not mistaken, was Ron McQuillan, and he had a hook. Mm-hmm. We called him Hook.
Like an actual.
Yeah, he lost his hand, and he had a hook, right? Do you remember that?
Was he a captain?
I've heard the stories, but I never saw him with my own eyes.
Yeah.
So.
I just remember a kid seeing the sheriff in the newspapers, and he always had a hook. And that was awesome.
Were you surprised when you saw a sheriff without a hook? Did you just think all sheriffs had hooks?
Yeah.
And he was a prerequisite.
Yeah.
And I mean, Hook was like one of my favorite movies at the time.
Yeah, that's a good movie.
Like, dang, man. He got a bit off by an alligator. A pirate.
So what was interesting is, like, it was really exciting for me to do the research and, like, see that the case did end up solved. I remember hearing something about it, but that's been, you know, years ago at this point. So a new Sentinel article from 2016 reported that the Jane Doe had been identified as Tina Marie McKinney Farmer from Indiana. Apparently, they had matched the Campbell County Jane Doe's fingerprints to Tina, and they got the idea to check after there was a description of Tina on a missing persons blog that matched the description of the Jane Doe that had been found. So they learned that Tina was 21 at the time she disappeared, and she was apparently last seen on Thanksgiving Day in 1984, according to an Indy Star article that I found.
Last seen in Indiana?
That was apparently the last time her family saw her. So it was unclear, like, how she got to Tennessee. And when I was looking for stuff earlier, I didn't even immediately see, like, was she found on the northbound side or the southbound side? Like, I'm... sure. Why, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And then the following year, in December 2019, a TBI news release identified Johns as the suspect in Tina's murder. Apparently, there had been some evidence at the scene that was resubmitted to the crime lab by the same detective who had walked me through the case in 2013. He went on to work for TBI. And when the evidence was processed, they found semen on the blanket that had been with the Campbell County Jane Doe. And the DNA matched back to our trucker serial killer, Jerry Johns.
Which is pretty strong evidence, I would say.
Right. I mean, that's a pretty open and shut case.
Right.
And the DA actually took that information to a Campbell County grand jury. And I guess almost symbolically is kind of the way I interpreted it, because the grand jury agreed that, like, if Jerry Johns hadn't died in prison in 2015, that they would have indicted him for first degree murder for that.
Right.
And I tried to find some information on, like, what ultimately killed Jerry Johns. He would have been 67 right. at the time when he died. So he was, you know, that's an old man to be in prison. But I couldn't find, like, a news release from the Department of Corrections saying that he died of natural causes or got, like, you know, injured somehow right. or whatever. But, nothing available on his cause of death other than being an old prisoner. I kind of want a FOIA for it, though.
Right. Yeah, that's yeah, that's pretty. That's you're right. That's an old prisoner, so a lot of things could happen, but you wouldn't expect a death of old age by that point. So,
yeah,
it could have been a number of things.
I couldn't even find an obituary for him. I was like, surely this dude's got somebody that might make sure he gets an obituary, right. but no, nothing. Absolutely nothing.
So two other women found same place or different places in Campbell County?
Pretty close to there. There were at least two more women dumped at Stinkin' Creek, but these didn't happen until 97 and 98. Both of these women have since been identified. One of them, her identity was known at the time of my 2013 article. The other one was not identified until 2022. And they were buried together at the Peabody Cemetery off of Highway 25 between La Follette and Jellicoe, because when I did my article, I went out to go see where they were buried because we wanted to get pictures of the tombstone that they shared, to have for the article. But yeah, they were buried way out in the middle of nowhere.
Right. And you'd send us that picture. That's always ominous to see that unknown on a tombstone.
And instead yeah. of a like a date of birth or date of death, it was just a found date and buried date. So mm-hmm. just so, and that's a Peabody Cemetery. I've actually been there. It's kind of in the mountains, but beautiful place, beautiful cemetery, kind of in the middle of nowhere. You really have no reason to go unless you know somebody in that area. So
I
are these
kind of have a funny. Oh, I was gonna say, I do have a funny Peabody Cemetery story. I don't know if you want it for the podcast. Oh,
yeah,
but,
go ahead.
I'll tell you. Okay. This is going to tie right back into Jellicoe.
It always does.
It always does. So, you know, it's the Southern tradition that, like, if there's a funeral procession, you don't bother it. You pull over, you leave them be, you let them do their thing. It's just how it goes.
Absolutely.
There was one particular day in Jellicoe that there had been, I don't remember if it was a bomb threat or something. In any case, I needed to get to Jellicoe from La Follette in a hurry. And the only way to do that is to go up and across the mountain on 25. So me and the intern and the photographer are all in my itty bitty Ford Fiesta, and I have floored it, and we are racing to get there. We're going to report the news. And we get not too far up the road from La Follette, and we realize we're behind a funeral procession and they're going insanely slow.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, what do we do? Because we know we've all been raised. You don't pass a funeral procession. That ain't decent.
Yeah.
Yep.
We follow them all the way until, you know, and 25W is a 2-lane road.
Very
so we follow them
windy.
Until it finally splits. and you get a passing lane when you're almost to Peabody Cemetery. Mm-hmm. And I look at the photographer and I look at the intern in the back seat and I'm like, guys, we're going to have to do something or we're never going to make it to Jellicoe. Because Peabody Cemetery is about the halfway point between La Follette and Jellicoe. So I floor it. And the intern and the photographer sink down so that they can't be seen in my vehicle. So I just look like a jerk. And about the time we get halfway past the funeral procession, they all turned off at Peabody. And if I had just been a little bit more patient.
Yeah. I was going to say, I know that Peabody turn is right there. So, mm-hmm. So
well, how was I supposed to know they were going?
Well, right.
Yeah. They could have went anywhere.
They could have been going for an hour.
Exactly.
So are the two women, are their cases connected, you think?
There was some talk of that in 1998. I found some newspaper records from then. The detective in Campbell County at the time thought that they could be connected just because their bodies were found about a mile apart along Stinking Creek Road. But it's one of those things like just nobody knows. But both of these women were stabbed. So, but we also don't know, like, with what. It's not like the articles say, you know, this one, you know, was stabbed with, you know, a knife probably like this. Like, so we don't have that comparison available. They were both stabbed. One of them was originally from Texas and one of them was originally from Ohio. So it doesn't look like they would have known each other based on where they grew up at. And Jerry Johns was in prison when they were found. But was it another killer? I don't know.
Now, and sorry, I'm getting my cases mixed up. Were You're these fine. Two connected to the Redhead murders or was that?
No, these two were not redheads. Okay. One of them was a black lady and the other lady was a Hispanic lady. So these were not redheaded ladies.
But again, two women basically found within a mile of each other. In a really short amount of time.
So. Mm-hmm. Yep, within 22 months. So the first woman was found January 1st, 1997. I don't know what it is about New Year's Day in Campbell County.
Yeah.
But well, maybe steer clear.
And that's where people are when we're finding the bodies, right? Not necessarily like, what are you all doing on New Year's Day where you're just out looking for
I'm wondering bodies. If there's a, I mean, it has to be deer hunters is yeah. what I would assume.
Oh, that's a good idea. It says, let's see, my notes here say that the January 1st, 1997, that passing motorists flagged down a CB operator to report a body along the side of the road.
Did you say that was 97 or 79? Because that right. sounds like an old
I know,
headline.
CB operator.
We were using CBs like in our trucks in high school.
Yeah, yeah, that is 79 in Jellicoe. I get it.
Yeah, you know, my best friend from high school also had a CB radio in his pickup truck, and we used it to speed places because the truckers would, he would just ask if there were any cops.
Right. It's better than a radar detector.
If you lived, quote unquote, on the mountain, you had one in your car so that you knew, you could tell, hey, guys, there's a coal truck coming at you. Breaker 19, over. Because the coal trucks use both lanes and you need to know, hey, slow yeah. down or get off the road here. Sure. There's a coal truck coming at you.
That makes complete sense because those turns are tight
yeah.
coming up over the mountain.
We call them kiss your butt curves. So January 1, 1997, when was the second body found?
She was found just before Halloween in 1998. So about a 22-month difference. The woman that was found in 1998 was found by a man who said he was picking up cans when he smelled death.
Yep.
So he called the cops, which is weird to me because I feel like if you're walking in the woods and you smell something dead, like my first thought, well, because of the line of work I'm in, my first thought is a dead body. But I feel like the natural supposition is like a deer.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, you know, I wouldn't,
critter of some kind.
I wouldn't think twice about it if I smelled something that smelled dead. If I was out in the woods, especially I just think it was an animal.
I mean, because yeah. I mean, how many deer have I seen dead on the interstate because it's literally just carved out of a mountain? So it's not uncommon.
Yeah. She was found about a mile from where the original woman was found. And by the original woman, I mean the 97 woman. authorities found a nude black female down an embankment. And my notes at the time had her 10 to 12 feet down the side of an embankment. She had a stab wound to her right breast, and she had a gunshot wound to the left side of her head. She was also clutching a handful of her own hair in her left hand. Medical examiner estimated she'd been dead 5 to 7 days at the time she was found. And she was a tiny woman. She only weighed 130 pounds. She was 5'6" tall, and they knew she was less than 40 years old. No tattoos, no noticeable scars. The only like distinguishing mark on her body was that she had a mark on her left hand, like she had been wearing a ring on her left ring finger, but the ring was missing. There was just like a really obvious indent that signified to them that she had worn a ring for a very long time.
It's just a weird coincidence to me. The first victim, going back to our very first, which was found in the 1985 and presumably by serial killer Jerry Johns, is that his name? Mm-hmm. We know he's in jail at this time. One of his victim also found to have ears pierced, no earrings in. This lady had a ring on. It's gone. So mm-hmm. it's like a, I don't know, just an oddity, I guess.
I know. Like it, if he wasn't in prison, we would all be like, oh, a calling card. He takes their jewelry, but
yeah, he was in prison. Usually if crimes are sexually motivated, you're not really looking to take jewelry off people. So it's an interesting, I don't know.
Also of note, growing up in a similar area, not a lot of diversity where I grew up, and I think Jellicoe's similar. So for an African-American victim to be found in unidentified, very few African-American families where I grew up, and I think if somebody was missing, everybody would know it. Is that the similar vibe in Jellicoe, or
Yeah, okay. For sure. And I think that goes to anybody in Jellicoe, white or black.
Right.
It's so small, and you know everybody. If Jimmy John, even though he's a deadbeat, doesn't come around, where's Jimmy John? So,
right.
Yeah, like, I think it's just
Jimmy John's not been loafing at the bar. So where is he?
Right. Yeah. I think that's more of a nature of Jellicoe, is it's so small. If it's anybody from there, that people are going to start talking.
Right. So certainly these victims not from around there.
Yeah.
Correct. I think that Stinking Creek is just so remote. Like it's just a good spot to dump a body, as terrible as that sounds, just because it's so remote and dark.
Especially truckers, people who drive that a lot, like that is obviously the most remote place to stop. Because even on the Kentucky side, there's Williamsburg, Corbin, like there's mm-hmm. somewhere close to everywhere. And after you get past there, going into Tennessee, it's a while before more civilization.
And yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And nobody gets off that exit. Like, it's safe to say that if I got off that exit right now, it could be 45 minutes to an hour before another car would get off, and they're probably lost.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Exactly. So your GPS is wrong. Don't take Stinking Creek. The only time I have ever taken the Stinking Creek exit was because the interstate was backed up. I was headed south. The interstate was backed up, and I needed the Oneida exit, which is the one after Stinking Creek. It's 3 miles after Stinking Creek if you're headed south. And I took the Stinking Creek exit to the logging road to go down to where I needed to go to, like, go back to my hometown.
Right.
Yeah. And that hasn't changed since 1985. Like, that exit is the same now mm-hmm. as it was in 85. So
wild.
So no identities ever produced for these women, or have they been able to find some identities now?
So actually, yeah, the January 1st, 97 woman, her name was Ada Elena Torres Smith from Texas. She had last been seen in 1996 at her boyfriend's house in Santee, South Carolina, which is 6 hours from where her body was discovered. She was originally from Texas, and it was her Texas family that reported her missing. I couldn't find any reports that said, like, what worried them to the point of reporting her missing. But she had been missing for about 6 months before her body was found in Campbell County. She was identified by the Doe Network, which is a nonprofit that works on matching unidentified bodies to missing people. So she was already identified when I wrote the article in 2007. The tombstone hadn't been updated, though, like when we went up to take the picture.
Yeah.
Right.
The other woman from 1998, she actually, her bones were exhumed in 2015. They were hoping that advances in DNA technology would be able to identify her, but it was actually fingerprints technology advancing that would allowed them to identify her. They had taken her fingerprints in 1998 when her body was found. And then by 2022, I don't know like why there was a 7-year lag other than everything's backed up.
Yeah.
In 2022, efforts like a multi-state effort to digitize fingerprint records and missing person cases, yada, yada, yada. Finally, it matched. And she was identified as Lori A. Alexander from Toledo, Ohio. She was reported missing in October 1998, like the same month that her body was discovered.
Okay.
Arrests were never made in either of these women's cases. Nobody knows who did it or what happened to them. I mean, it's a safe bet to say it wasn't Jerry Johns.
Yeah.
There's nothing definitive to say that they're even related other than the fact that they were both stabbed.
So both stabbed, but only Halloween woman had a gunshot wound, or did Correct. Both have a gunshot wound?
Correct, according to what I could find.
Wow.
I'm just so glad that they got identified. I remember like feeling so hopeless when I was writing the cold case story in 2013. You know, the redhead hadn't been identified and Lori Alexander hadn't been identified then. So it was kind of nice to go back and like revisit the article and be like, oh, wait, no, like they did solve at least some of it.
Especially with the exhumation, like that's expensive. That usually takes a lot to get that to happen. Was that just authorities trying to solve this case? Was this some other organization pushing to help pay for it? Like, how did that come about? Because that's very surprising to me.
Yeah, so the 2015 report that I read from WATE, which is the ABC affiliate here in Knoxville, all that it said was that, you know, investigators exhumed the body. So okay. I don't know if they were just, they just were like, okay, let's try this out. Because at that point, she would have been, to my knowledge, maybe the only other unknown grave in that cemetery for sure. So,
no, that's great. I was just surprised that it happened without somebody who may think it was a family member, or that's usually what it takes. So yeah, great.
Were all three of these cases investigated by Brandon Elkin in Campbell County around the same time?
He was the detective in 2013, and he was my point person when I showed up to say, I want to talk about the cold cases. So as far as I know, like he, you know, they were open investigations. I don't know how much work he was doing on them at any given time. But he was.
But when the bodies were discovered, he probably wasn't around yet. Is that safe? Because
he wasn't
too young.
Yeah. But he would have been doing the cold cases much later. So there's another case from Campbell County that's still, unsolved, as far as I'm aware. So tell us more about that one. And I do remember this one.
This one is weird because I was like, I expected an update. You know, I was 3 for 3 on updates. So I was like, oh, this will be fine. I'm going to find out what happened to this guy too. No, nobody knows where this guy is either.
Okay.
So his name is David Joseph Burge. And he went missing from an area of La Follette called Coolidge, which is like southeast of downtown La Follette, kind of out towards the lake.
Just a side note, this is where my wife's family lives currently. This is when I go visit them on a Sunday, this is where I go to church. I cannot overemphasize how small of an area this is. Like Jellicoe small, this area is like tiny and everybody knows everybody and everybody's related.
Because it's really hard to leave the holler.
Yeah, and it is a holler for sure.
It is for sure a holler. Yeah, one of my editors at the press, he lived in that area. So, but yeah, very tiny little community. I don't even think there's any signs. I don't know where Coolidge quits and Demery starts or anything like that.
I think you know Alan Miller, and he lives in Coolidge. So,
oh, does he?
Yeah, just a really small area. So David lived in this area. How old was David?
He was 21 when he went missing. in 2001. So his grandmother, Wanda Teague, she last saw him on June 15th, 2001 at their house. Apparently she had gone on a trip or something. When she come home 3 days later, she found his wallet and his keys, but no grandson. And she reported him missing at that time. The detective that was working, you know, that was responsible for the case at the time I did my initial story, said that this guy had been in like some minor trouble with the law. He had a pending theft charge. There was a charge for littering, a public intoxication, underage consumption, like things that you would get probation for as a 21-year-old, and it would eventually be off your record. Not something you run from. It's not like he was, you know, he'd robbed a bank or killed somebody. And the grandma, I actually called his grandma when I was doing the case. She lived in the same house where he had disappeared from. She hadn't changed her number in all that time and was just waiting. She told me in 2013 that she waffled back and forth on whether or not, you know, she believed he was alive or dead. She obviously hoped for the best. Through the years, the authorities, you know, they conducted several searches for Burge. They did cadaver dogs across hundreds of acres, came up empty. The only dental records that they had for this guy were from when he was 10. And I got to thinking about it. The anatomy of your mouth as an adult versus what it was at 10 would have been drastically different. Oh, so the dental records weren't going to be any good, because at 10, he still would have had several baby teeth to lose, as well as getting those third molars and eventually his wisdom teeth. So kind of useless.
Right.
You know, the detective then told me that there were some persons of interest, but like no concrete answers. And the weird thing about this is like there's no paper trail. There's nothing on this guy. He never tried to get any utilities like opened in his name. He never applied for a credit card, never applied for a job. Like there was nothing. He'd never paid taxes. He just disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, I have my personal speculations on what may have happened with him. I don't know that they're appropriate to share, because I certainly don't know this guy. And the only trouble he was ever in was, like you said, a littering charge and a public intoxication charge. But I'll go on record to say that, you know, there's really not a whole lot of opportunity in this area. And if he's not out trying to get a job and trying to work, then how is he, you know, what's he doing with his time? And it's, in my opinion, it's likely that he could have been running around with some questionable characters. What were his friends like? Were they into stuff? Did they do, or was he running drugs? Were they running drugs? Did he get mixed up in something that he shouldn't have been a part of? Because I don't think you just go missing and leave your wallet behind. And, you know, I don't think he has a reason to run. And where would he run to? You know,
right. And you're not going to get too far if you didn't have a job to spend your money on.
Yeah. And this is so, 2001. Like, it's fairly easy to track people. To go off the grid completely, even then, would have been tough to disappear intentionally. Mm-hmm. And not to, again, dismiss backgrounds, but it doesn't sound like a tech savvy individual that's able to records and that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, his wallet, like, being left behind is a big tell that something was wrong, yep. You know, with, like, the whole situation. His wallet was actually with the binder of all the notes at the sheriff's department.
Yeah.
Which was weird to see.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that also Elkin that was researching this case? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep, he was my point person for all of these cases.
I saw your notes, a big red binder with his wallet still in an
evidence bag. Yeah.
So yeah, all these cases from Campbell County, most of them still, well, in my mind, really all of them still unsolved, because the first one we talked about was never really connected to the serial killer. But in my mind, there's a high likelihood that we have the two women that were thankfully identified. don't know what happened to them. Maybe they were same murderer, maybe not. I mean, it's possible. And then we have this guy that disappeared. I don't think this guy was in any way connected to anybody else's case that we've already talked about today, but just fascinating that in Campbell County, Tennessee, so many unsolved mysteries.
So many. Well, and I bet if we Googled, we would probably find more that have happened even since I quit working in Campbell County, because I don't think they ever found Rhonda Darty's body.
No, I'm almost certain they did not.
I mean, we're fairly certain we know what happened to her, but we don't, you know, like there is no body.
Yeah. And that's the one connected to the teacher, Vaughn, right? Or mm-hmm. Van. So, Van, yeah, he was convicted of her murder. But we have never found her body, and I think they know about where it would be, but it's a huge lake, and and there's just no feasible way to search the entire thing.
Well, I'm pretty sure last summer I saw a news article that they had found another body in the lake. It wasn't Rhonda Darty, and they were, you know, you know how news reports go. It'll be like, you know, authorities, you know, we'll provide an update later, and there's never any update.
Well, Beth, thank you for coming on. This has been just so fascinating, and I think we can just keep researching unsolved mysteries in Campbell County and probably be able to do this again soon. So,
yeah, it sounds like this is all from your time there, 2013 and before. So we can have a follow up episode for the last decade.
Yeah. I could only imagine like what we'll find like if we keep looking, because Campbell County, like, it's a beautiful place. It's got mountains. It's got lakes. It's got, you know, the people are really nice, like 99% of the time. But that place has some secrets.
Yeah.
Mountains, mines, and murder. That's a new podcast idea we could have for Campbell County.
Yep. Run it by your folks at Luna Shark. We'll host it. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, no, we really appreciate it. This is certainly fascinating stuff. And we try to bring a lot of cases from smaller towns, and it doesn't get much smaller than that area. So these are stories that probably don't get told a lot elsewhere. So thanks so much.
Absolutely.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.